Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Oh yeah, the old Hollywood liberal conspiracy. What do they call it?
You commie, homo-loving sons of guns.
Whoa! Sean Penn wins an Oscar and outs the Academy for honoring his performance in the movie Milk. He also apologizes for being a jerk sometimes. In a nearly four-hour award show, one spontaneous moment. I think we can do better than that on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Adora Udoji is away. It's all Oscars. All Oscars last night. It was very, very exciting. Coming up this hour, we're going to also study the agenda in Washington. There's a lot on the agenda in Washington. We're going to talk with two very informed guests on what's going on this week. Plus, an alarming new study says child abuse is powerful enough to affect your genes. All that and coming up with a motto for America in 2009. Can you top that, Femi? Okay?
I think I can. It's all about money and when you might get it. That's happening in D.C. this week. The administration starts a week-long budget rollout today with a summit on fiscal responsibility. President Obama also meets with state governors who have stimulus money coming their way.
You're where the rubber hits the road, and you have to make tough decisions all the time, even when there's a lot of fussing and fighting here in Washington.
Tuesday night, the president will give a speech to Congress, and Thursday he turns in his budget proposal. The president's goal is cutting the budget deficit in half by the end of his term, and he will do that mainly through tax hikes on the wealthy and Iraq war spending cuts.
News this morning says taxpayers could soon own a much bigger chunk of shaky megabank Citigroup. Wall Street Journal reports the government is in talks to buy as much as a 40% stake as a result of a capital injection. A new economic forecast is packed with bad news about jobs. The National Association for Business Economics predicts unemployment will hit 9% this year. The group's president is Chris Varveris, and he says there's hope for next year.
It's not a pretty picture through all of 2009, but at least we will see positive growth this year. And 2010 is expected to see modestly above-trend growth that should help to get the unemployment rate on a gradual downward track.
The group predicts the American economy will shrink by nearly 2% this year. Who asked them?
So, we had a little bit...
Shock you there, Femi?
Yeah, was that a hypothetical question? Did you want
no.
an answer, John?
Who asked that?
Okay.
Stop bringing us down, man.
So we started with a little bit of the Oscars at the top of the program. Slumdog Millionaire actually was the big Academy Award winner.
Huge.
The film grabbed 8 Oscars last night, including Best Picture. Kate Winslet won Best Actress. Also, really good speech, Kate. Heath Ledger won a posthumous Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. And a little later, we'll have an Oscar conversation with New York Times carpetbagger blogger David Carr.
A couple of quick things. Our partners at the New York Times say on a front page story that U.S. military aid to Pakistan is much bigger than either country has revealed. The Dow and S&P dipped more than 1%, but are poised for a positive open this morning. We welcome the city of Detroit to the Takeaway family this morning. WDET in Detroit begins broadcasting our program, The Takeaway. From this point on, the nation is turning around.
Good morning, Detroit.
We've hit the bottom. Good morning, Detroit. And it's all recovery from here on out on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
Finding that out's a good mission for a Monday morning, and this is our agenda segment where we look forward to the week in Washington. And joining us is April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks. We welcome her back. April, good morning.
Good morning, John.
She's in Baltimore. And Todd Spangler is the Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press. He's on the line from Washington. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, John.
And Todd, we want to say, you know, we are thrilled to be in your market. We go on the air in Detroit as of today. So we're doubly thrilled to have you with us, Todd.
We're thrilled to have you.
All right, great. So let's talk about this agenda this week. April, let me begin with you. It seems as though Barack Obama was suggesting yesterday, and the sort of Washington agenda is shifting to the regular old budget. We had, you know, $787 billion of spending on the stimulus, but hey, we forgot about the regular old budget. Can you remind me again of the difference between what they did to spend 2 weeks ago and what they're going to be doing this week?
Well, this week, the White House is warning that we are facing some austere times, and they're trying to balance some things out with sacrifices and some investments. And the way we understand it, that the president is going to try in his budget that will be announced Thursday to cut the federal budget in half by the end of his first term. Now, he's also going to tax some people, and where the sacrifices are allegedly going to come from are from cuts to funding some projects with the war in Iraq.
So, Todd, does that mean that the response to, to make up for the spending on the stimulus package, the budget is going to be sort of anesthetized? I mean, can he really make it up? Does the math work out, Todd?
Oh, I think there'd be a long shot of actually making the math work out long term from here. But right now the president's in the business of raising expectations instead of trying to manage them down. I mean, he's trying to come out and say, not only can I do something about, you know, to stimulate the economy and to get the banks going and to do something about foreclosures, but I can also accomplish these things I set out for in the campaign, that I'm going to reform health care. At the same time, I'm going to keep an eye on deficit reduction. I mean, that he's having, you know, bipartisan members of Congress come over today to talk about what can we do long term. I don't think anybody really expects a lot to come out of that today in terms of the concrete steps that would go forward. But it looks like they're doing something, and he knows this is a lot about, you know, public expectations at this point.
Well, let's hear those expectations straight from the president's mouth. This is him speaking on his Saturday radio address.
That work begins on Monday, when I will convene a fiscal summit of independent experts and unions, advocacy groups, and members of Congress to discuss how we can cut the $1 trillion deficit that we've inherited. On Tuesday, I will speak to the nation about our urgent national priorities. And on Thursday, I'll release a budget that's sober in its assessments, honest in its accounting, and lays out in detail my strategy for investing in what we need, cutting what we don't, and restoring fiscal discipline.
April, I should remind people that's actually not a radio address as much as it is an internet address. You can hear the sort of digital quality there. It's a, you know, it's a whole new business with the Obama administration. Describe that summit that he's talking about. How important is that? And then the speech on Tuesday.
Well, what happens is this week he's trying to give the American public something that they can chew on. And it's interesting in talking to the White House sources about what's happening this week. They said, you know, it's kind of ironic. You know, he ran on the issue of the audacity of hope. And now he has to be very clear-eyed in giving the reality, the scope of the financial situation for this country. And today he deals with about 130 people at the White House talking about more long-term discussions on the economy and fixing the economy. And the final product is not inked yet. All the I's aren't dotted and the T's aren't all crossed, but they're hoping that, you know, today won't, you know, be anything new to throw in there. But at the same time, they're still holding out to cross all the I's, to cross all the T's and dot all the I's for Thursday with the budget. And Tuesday, tomorrow, the president is going to have to find a balance to rally the people and the markets so the markets don't go down as he's talking about the reality of what's going on in the financial blueprint that he's going to give out, as well as just talking, giving his statements to the joint session of Congress that basically the White House is looking at as something to give to the world because of the world economy and how the U.S. and the world economy play together. So he's got a lot on his hands right now this week.
Well, it's billed as a State of the Union-like speech, and I could actually coin a title from what April was saying there. Todd, let me try this out on you. Mr. Audacity of Hope is going to give a speech that would veer dangerously close to the reality of hopelessness. How does he avoid that?
Well, and Mr. Audacity of Hope better also realize that he's getting a lot of airtime right now. I mean, April's absolutely right. The balance here has to be not only trying to raise expectations, I mean, really trying to rally the markets and get people behind him. He also needs to be worried about talking a little bit too much, being out there so much and trying to instill so much hope without a lot happening in the markets, and that makes him appear ineffective at times. And I think it's way too early to make those sort of snap judgments about him. But, I mean, this speech tomorrow night is a major, major speech for any new president. And in this economy, it doesn't get any bigger than this. He really needs to hopefully see something coming out of the markets on Wednesday to make this seem that he's really making a difference.
Well, April, let me throw that to you. Is there danger of Obama fatigue somewhere out there on the horizon?
Yes, there is. Everyone's talking about it. I just hearken back to a couple of weeks ago when he had those five major network news conferences. It was like he was in the Oval Office, and he had each one back-to-back. One anchor person or news person would get out of the chair, and another one would come in. And it was basically the same thing over and over again. And it was so interesting, and that was the time when you had a big controversy about one of his cabinet appointments. But even before then, he was giving interviews back-to-back. He had the press conference. And you have to be concerned with that because you don't want Obama fatigue. You don't want him to be too oversaturated in the market. Yes, there are issues going on, but you know he has to find a balance so people will listen to what he has to say instead of just saying, oh, here he goes again. So you want that winning picture, and you want to see him on a winning side. But when he continues to talk constantly about the negatives, Bill Clinton is right. He has to find a way to say it, to bring hope, and bring back that audacity of hope that people wanted during the campaign and people put him in the office for.
All right. Well, we will tune in for that on Tuesday, and we'll probably be assessing the effectiveness of that speech on Wednesday morning. But let's shift gears a little bit. We were hearing all through the weekend from governors around the nation some of the aftershocks, I think, from the lack of bipartisanship on the stimulus package. Listen to this, and then I want to ask you about it.
The bigger philosophical point is this. I just have a fundamental disagreement with this package.
This, to me, is not about philosophical theory. This is about real people.
At times it sounds like the Soviet grain quotas of Stalin's time.
People want that help.
There's some we will not take in Mississippi.
So you better believe I'm going to take every dollar that is coming to Michigan, I'll take their dollars too.
Wait a minute, we're over here too. We'll take it too.
Now, Todd Spangler, I'll begin with you because that was your Governor Grunholm there talking about taking the stimulus money and really needing to get that delivered to communities all around your state. But generally, it seemed like some of these governors, particularly the Republican governors, are in a tough situation. They definitely have resources to give to their people, but they also want to look like they're ideologically in line with the congressional Republicans who didn't vote for this.
Well, they're having the Republican governors are having a split. I mean, it's pretty clear amongst themselves. I mean, you have governors like Schwarzenegger in California who they're not going to turn down anything at this point. I mean, their situation is as dire almost as it is in a place like Michigan. Maybe not quite that bad. But, you know, and then you have people like Haley Barbour and Bobby Jindal who are trying to walk more of an ideological line who honestly, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, that they believe that this is not the way to stimulate their economy, and they want to stick to their guns on that. But as you heard, I mean, Governor Granholm, things are not good in a place like Michigan, and I think there are lots of governors out there who would say, listen, if they don't want the money, we'll take it.
April, how can any governor, and we're running out of time here, but how can any governor not spend in this environment with, approaching 10% unemployment and say we're saving the country?
Todd is absolutely right. You know, last night I was in the room, I was in the dining room when the president gave his toast to the governors. And ironically, Republican governor from California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, was sitting front and center right next to First Lady Obama. Okay, so he is there. He is in dire need. And then we go to a place like New Orleans, a city that needs the money, and their governor is saying, hey, you know, let's take a look at this. I may or may not, at the end of the day, you have to look at the fact that there's a need, and you can play partisan politics for a while, but when your cities are in need, Detroit, you know, again, the state of Michigan, a lot of manufacturing states around the country, you know, many states are in trouble.
Right.
They need to get the money.
The posturing is fine for the dinner parties, I guess, but when these governors get home, the party's going to be over. April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks, and Todd Spangler, Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press. That's The Agenda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
My motto is, six words, buy often, buy American, buy now.
Can you do better than that? We're looking for a six-word motto to help America get through these troubled times in 2009. Tell us your six-word motto for America for 09. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now perhaps you have the impression that experiences that you have could possibly be encoded deep within your genes and be passed on to your offspring. Well, there's no evidence for that. There's all kinds of impressions we have about how DNA works. But the science of it, particularly as it regards environmental factors, is just becoming clear. And Michael Meany joins us now. He's the co-director of the Sackler Program for Epigenetics and Psychobiology at McGill University in Montreal. And he's the lead author of an extraordinary paper that was published this week in Nature, Neuroscience. It's an article on the biological effects of child abuse detected inside our genetic structure. Michael Meany, first of all, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I just want to sketch out very, very briefly, you looked at child abuse as an event because, I mean, it certainly doesn't take a scientist to know that that is a blunt trauma to all aspects of child development. But did you choose child abuse because you thought it would be more likely to show up genetically or that you had some prior evidence going in that it was likely to code genetically in people's cells?
It's the latter in large measure. I mean, as you point out, it's going to come as no surprise to people who study child development to know that parental care can have long-term influences, and in part, those influences are exerted over the way we respond to stress. So what we tried to do is to simply ask the question, how does that happen? How is it that an event that occurs early in life can have such pervasive and long-term effects? So we developed a model with rats, and surprisingly as it may sound, these effects recapitulate themselves rather nicely in the rat. So simply put, the quality of maternal care in the rat, the way the mother interacts with her pup, predicts the way the offspring respond to stress in adulthood. And so we then had the basis by which we could start to understand how that occurred, and simply put, the mother's care alters the activity of genes in the brain that regulate the stress response. We took it one step further and asked, how could that happen? How does maternal care, an essentially social event, modulate the activity of genes over potentially over the lifespan? And what we found when we looked at the DNA was that the DNA carried particular marks dependent on the quality of maternal care. Now, these marks are what we call epigenetic marks. We're all familiar with the genetic code. It's a nucleotide sequence. It's really the bread and butter, if you will, of the gene. But over the course of development, the gene accumulates these molecular marks, which are simply molecules that are laid down on the DNA. And the mother's behavior actually influences this process. And the molecules actually determine the level of activity of that region of the DNA.
Well, let's pull two things out. Let's just pull two things out there. One, this epigenetic world that I want to talk to about in a moment is theoretically a domain which possibly encodes all kinds of very, very complex behaviors, including some that occur in the environment. And secondly, you observed the behavior in rats apparently being passed on, and you went to look for it, and this is what you found. Is that a fair assessment of how the study worked?
Yeah, I think I would, just to back up to your first question, the epigenetics are really just as, exactly as you point out in your introduction. They are, if you will, almost an environmental trace that's left on the DNA itself in the form of these bio, these molecular marks that are put, that are literally attached onto the DNA. So it is, in a way, a trace of early developmental history that persists into adulthood and can alter the activity of the genome.
Now, is this a kind of an archive as it functions in the cells, or is it actually a lever that could possibly be manipulated whereby therapies could be designed to mitigate the effects of child abuse or reverse the effects of child abuse?
Well, I think you can think of them as both. I mean, essentially what we were trying to do in the human study, for example, is to create some kind of an analog by which we could ask whether the same processes are occurring in humans. To go back to your first point, we actually looked at abuse because it's something we can document very clearly when you're working with an adult organism. So as you can imagine, if you're working in this particular case, we're actually studying the brains of individuals who have completed suicide or have died of accidental circumstances, almost invariably car accidents. And this is what refers to the paper, the current paper. The abuse is something that can be documented very clearly. And so we look at that both in terms of, as you suspected, the fact that it is traumatic and likely to leave such an imprint. And then second, because it can be documented historically. And so you can actually verify its presence or absence in these individuals.
And the mechanism in rats is almost precisely duplicated in humans based on your initial results?
I think based on the initial results, the best way to put it is the human data, that is that these traces are derivable from the history of abuse, is consistent with what we've seen in the rat. Of course, in the rat, we can get in there and see exactly how these traces are being laid down. But at least within simply being able to document the relationship is actually a fairly reasonable advance.
Well, it's an extraordinarily exciting advance. Finally, parents out there are going to hear what you say and assume that there's a kind of deterministic quality here, that a victim of child abuse, if it affects their genes, they're permanently damaged. What would you say to parents who are asking
question? I'm glad you brought it back to that, because that's a critical point. The beauty of these epigenetic marks is that they are potentially reversible. And they, at least the types of epigenetic marks that we're looking at, are not necessarily going to be transmitted from parent to offspring. So you needn't be sitting around there saying, look, I've been damaged, ergo my children will be damaged regardless of how good a parent I am. That's not right. These epigenetic marks, the kind of that we're speaking of and where they're located, are pretty much wiped clean in the next generation. That, on the other hand, what that really sets us up for, as any developmentalist will caution you, is that we know that individuals who were abused as a child are very likely to be compromised in their own parental care. And so what it suggests then is that the level of intervention is that you definitely want to be targeting the parental care of these high-risk individuals, and particularly, of course, caring for their mental health.
A great takeaway, a great breakthrough, and the story is in Nature Neuroscience. Michael Meany is the co-director of the Sackler Program for the Epigenetics and Psychobiology at McGill University in Montreal. His study is all about the effect of child abuse on our genes. We thank Michael for joining us, and Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
At 29 minutes past the hour, state governors returned to the White House today for a final discussion on spending the economic stimulus cash coming their way. The president is also expected to announce that Interior Department Inspector General Earl Devaney will head a board overseeing stimulus spending. Israel's Labour Party leader will not join a unity government with Conservative Benjamin Netanyahu. He's on the verge of becoming prime minister. Right now, Netanyahu is rounding up the party support he needs to make it official. He wants a broad coalition and is in talks with his rival, centrist leader Tzipi Livni. That's a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Folks, I'm serious about this. We need a motto.
I would like our motto to be, let's spend our way to happiness.
We're looking for a six-word motto to help America get through these troubled times in 2009. Our friend Stephen Dubner is going to be in tomorrow to talk about entries that he's judging. But Sean Penn even weighed in last night.
You commie, homo-loving sons of guns.
Sorry, Sean, that's more than six words, but tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It was a great series of moments last night. If you watched the Oscars, Slumdog Millionaire, of course, won 8 awards, and Kate Winslet won for Best Actress, and Sean Penn, as I noted just there, was accepting for his role in Milk. Joining us now is David Carr, culture reporter, columnist for the New York Times. We spoke last Friday where we had a whole strategy figured out for the red carpet moment, how to deal with the celebrity superficiality at the Oscars last night. And David, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, it seems to me that for all the talk we had last week about superficial celebrities, et cetera, the whole moment last night was a kind of a hodgepodge of global culture and serious talk of human rights. And I was actually surprised at how sort of sober and really not superficial the entire affair seemed to be to me.
Well, you have to keep in mind that Hollywood is, you know, sort of the last remaining export that the rest of the world is interested in, and they don't want to seem too out of touch with the times that they're in. To just come out and simply do song and dance and not at least flick at or reflect the broader things that are underway, I don't think is really good for business.
I mean, there was a mortality theme, whether you're talking about Mickey Rourke and his dog, you know, wearing the pendant and telling everybody about it. And then there was, of course, Heath Ledger.
Yeah, we all know Loki now.
Yeah, no kidding. But then there was also this sense of, you know, here's the emergence of Slumdog Millionaire and the whole Bollywood scene, a global culture taking center stage.
Yeah, what I was struck by is, you know, you open with song and dance. It seems straight out of the 1930s, 1940s, kind of a depression or post-depression song and dance. And then it sort of bumped into a lot of Bollywood trade dress, which after all is a version of that Hollywood kind of coming back at us. And it was underpinned. I mean, you can't have Heath Ledger's family get up there and not have a moment of really profound sadness about what is lost. And I think that his death and the need to acknowledge that kind of hung over things a little bit as well.
Right. And, of course, Hugh Jackman, there's one talented guy, wouldn't you say?
I don't think there are a lot of people that could do that high-low thing that he did and really pulled off. He was both doing things earnestly and ironically at the same time. Very gifted performer, big range of talent. I know the producers were very happy. And I got to tell you, in the room, I was in a press room, but in the room, I was just at the Vanity Fair party, and people were fairly ecstatic about what they saw.
Yeah, well, it was a great show, actually. Of course, you know, I can only watch the beginning of it because I have to go to bed, right, to do this show. But how did it work with the questions? You solicited questions on our website, on your own blog, of things that were out of the ordinary to ask celebrities on the red carpet. How did that go?
Well, we all have our cross to bear. You had to go to bed. I had to hit the carpet, John, so we could argue about who had the tougher duty. One of the questions I think it was your listener came up with was, who else in your in your group of nominees would you select? And Kate Winslet said automatically that it would be Meryl. I also asked her if she did any carb loading before she came out, and she said she was far too nervous to eat anything. I asked Franklin Langella, and this is a question from your listeners, if playing Nixon changed his opinion of the man. He said, no, I had no opinion of who he was on purpose. And so I didn't develop or change any opinions. He is an actor's actor. I asked all the Slumdog kids, if you were paid in candy, what would it be? And there were eight of them together, and they each shouted a different candy.
Wow.
Some were Snickers, some were M&Ms, some were Indian candies. I never heard of, but they did say in unison as they walked away, Jai Ho, which I thought was really, really cute. Danny Boyle was fairly serious on the carpet, as you sort of mentioned earlier, and I asked what the broader lesson of a little movie made for under $20 million in Mumbai, India, had to say to the film world, and he said, we have to maintain the capacity to surprise, to come out of nowhere, to still remain vital as a cinema. Penelope Cruz had a very good bit about, and I've heard this once before, about the day she was scheduled to do a love scene with Scarlett Johansson. Kind of a moment I think all of us might want to be on set for, you know.
See. So. Well, so you actually did get some substance in there. I mean, from the, you know, little discussion of the love scene there to Danny Boyle being serious. I love this idea of the capacity of cinema to surprise. And really, you know, what that says, if Slumdog Millionaire does so well, what really has the capacity to surprise us is looking broadly in the world, not just in the same old kinds of stories and remakes that Hollywood's been doing for so long.
Well, I saw a big-time Hollywood producer. He was at the Governor's Ball. Afterwards, he said, well, so this means I could make a movie in China, Han. And I just said to him, well, you always could. It's just Hollywood tends to move down, you know, fairly. They don't want to take, they want to minimize risk as much as possible. And Slumdog is a dream of a movie in that it's made for not much, just click past $100 million. And, you know, you could look in the past, as Danny Boyle mentioned, he said, look at Juno, you know, last year, came out of nowhere and did really, really huge business.
Hunger for surprises there, David Carr. That's a great takeaway. David Carr, carpetbagger blogger for the New York Times, giving us some surprising moments from Hollywood last night at the Oscar celebration. Hey ho. How about some hey ho headlines from Femi Oke?
Hello there. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama hosts a fiscal responsibility summit today for members of Congress, economists, and many others. They will focus on how to reduce the deficit while reviving the economy. And that's a major focus of the president's coming budget outline. He will send it to Congress on Thursday, and he also gives a major speech to Congress tomorrow night. The U.S. government is in talks to buy up to a 40% share of bank giant Citigroup. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. And that would be the biggest government ownership of a financial institution since its bailout of AIG last fall. Two more papers are filing for bankruptcy. Philadelphia Newspapers, which owns The Inquirer and Daily News, filed for Chapter 11 Sunday, citing crushing debt. And the company has been negotiating with creditors for about a year, but their talks broke down. And those are a few of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adore Udoji is away. So if you've spent most of your life in North America, okay, you probably think Eurovision is a brand of sunglasses that Germans wear, okay? But if you've spent any time in Europe at all, you know that Eurovision is possibly the most popular, the most tension-filled confrontation between the various cultures on the continent of Europe. And this year, there's a political battle brewing. Tom Esselmont joins us. He's a BBC correspondent in Tbilisi in Georgia. First of all, Tom, Eurovision, it couldn't be huger, right?
That's right. It's a pretty large thing, and it's certainly looks like it could be a tension-filled, conflict-ridden, exciting event this year. Eurovision is not supposed to be political, but this year, by all accounts, if this song, which has been written by a Georgian group, and has been voted for by public gets through to the contest as it looks set to do so, it could be extremely controversial indeed.
All right, let's talk about the details then, because remember, I'm dealing with mostly Americans here. Eurovision is a song contest. If in Moscow, where the Eurovision contest is going to be, where the finals are going to be, if this Georgian song is played, and let's not forget there was an invasion of Georgia by Russia last year, it could have very, very direct sort of insulting consequences for the president of, or the prime minister of Russia, Vladimir Putin. Let's first of all listen to the song, and then I want your reaction. In one sense, this is just about like every other Eurovision song I've ever heard, but because it says put in, there's a play on words there, and that is causing like serious political consequences, Tom?
You're right. The words are put in, but the way they say it or sing it is Putin, which you don't have to listen too carefully to hear the name of the Russian prime minister, as you say, Vladimir Putin. The key thing is, though, that this group who is singing the song Stefan and 3G deny that they have that this song is at all political. They say it's just a funky song that's right for Eurovision because it's important for Georgia to enter Eurovision, and they are, by all accounts, anyway, a group of sort of funky band members with white sunglasses and big hair, all the sort of things that you need if you're going to take part in Eurovision. But indeed, if this is at all a political song, and certainly that seems to be the way that many people in Russia might see it, then it could be extremely controversial indeed.
And indeed, as you say, this group is sort of the Georgian version of ABBA. In any sense, is this a throwback to the Cold War years where so much culture and poetry was buried in deeply coded samizdat kinds of places?
It potentially could be, yeah. It's interesting you mention ABBA because it's important to remember that Vladimir Putin, the Russian Prime Minister, is known to be not a fan of ABBA anyway. So in a sense, in this song, the Georgian band have done two things which could potentially aggravate the situation. They've sung a very 70s-style cheesy number, and they're going to be singing it in Moscow in the finals in May.
Wow.
And finally, they're mentioning what sounds like his name.
Well, Tom Esselman, BBC correspondent in Tbilisi, thanks for sorting it all out for us. Eurovision, it's an international incident once again.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, the details of a somewhat schizophrenic standoff between Russia and the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. More about that in a moment. But first, headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The economy is a major conversation topic this week in Washington. President Obama will host a fiscal responsibility summit today for members of Congress, economists, and others. Tomorrow is expected to be a major topic during the president's address to a joint session of Congress. Attorney General Eric Holder is in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba today. He's charged with leading the administration's effort to shut down the site. He says he wants to talk with officials there about detention and interrogation techniques. So, how excited would you be if you'd just flown on a plane for the first time? You get dressed up to go to the Oscars, and journalists want to interview you on the red carpet. You would probably be this excited.
It's unbelievable, you know, walking on the red carpet, and it's unbelievable. It's a dream come true.
And we're trying to get used to it.
So, two of the young stars from the movie Slumdog Millionaire. The kids didn't go home disappointed. Slumdog Millionaire won 8 Oscars, including Best Picture. Other winners included Best Actor Sean Penn for Milk and Best Actress Kate Winslet for The Reader. The U.S. government is in talks to buy up to a 40% share of Citigroup. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. And the move wouldn't cost taxpayers additional money, but other Citigroup shareholders would see their stock go down.
Such a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that capital injection program is going to begin on Wednesday, according to the Treasury.
Okay, I will look out for that. Bring that to you on Wednesday.
Thank you, Femi.
I think I'm done.
Thank you.
I have 10 seconds. Yes. I can't do news in 10 seconds.
You came up with a great motto to keep us going here in America. Yeah. Could you repeat it again? It's one of my favorites of the morning. Quickly.
What's the motto with you, America?
Well, you have an alternative to Femi's motto, don't you?
Mary LaFrance, Detroit, Michigan. You know, a lot of our money is going overseas to support sweatshops. We should be working here. How about shut down the sweatshops?
Kind of a narrow motto, but a lot of passion there. Fritz sent us an email. It is what it is. Deal. Tell us your six-word motto for America for 2009. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So last week, Russia marked the 20th anniversary of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan with avowals from its leader that they really, really, truly do not want the American military mission there to suffer the same humiliating fate. But there is something of a standoff going on between the U.S. and Russia over a base in Kyrgyzstan. Russia wants it closed and has actually convinced the Kyrgyzstan government to close the base. But yet Russia is also allowing materiel to go across its territory into Afghanistan. It's as though Hamlet and a standoff are kind of fused together in this strange sort of snapshot of U.S.-Russian relations. Joining us now to explain what this might mean, both for the 20th anniversary of the ill-fated Afghan invasion that the people of Russia are remembering this week, and also relations going forward with the Obama administration, is the New York Times' Clifford Levy, who's the Moscow bureau chief. He joins us from Moscow. Clifford, your story on this curious standoff between the U.S. and Russia, where it doesn't seem to be, I mean, the Russians don't seem to be able to make up their mind whether they want the U.S. to succeed in Afghanistan or they want the U.S. to fail in Afghanistan. What does that say about overall Russian policy towards the United States?
Well, John, I just think they're very conflicted. On the one hand, a failed state, a truly failed state in Afghanistan would be very bad for Russia on a number of fronts. Russia really fears the threat of the spread of Islamic extremism into Central Asia and then farther into southern Russia, where they're already battling an Islamic extremist insurgency in Chechnya and other parts of southern Russia. And you know, it's not really well known, but they have a terribly, terribly serious problem with heroin addiction in Russia, and it's gone much, much worse. It's just skyrocketed since the fall of the Soviet Union. And, of course, all that heroin is coming from Afghanistan. So they really want a major crackdown on poppy production in Afghanistan, which, of course, is not happening right now. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, they have a hard time with the big American presence in Afghanistan, and especially they have a hard time with an American troop presence in Central Asia, in these former Soviet republics of Central Asia. They increasingly are asserting what they feel is their zone, what they refer to as their zone of influence. We saw that obviously most vividly in the conflict in Georgia last August, where they repulsed the Georgians and then went and invaded Georgia. And that part of that was really a blow at what they saw as Western encroachment or NATO encroachment into the former Soviet Union. So it's sort of like the Russian brain knows that a failed state in Afghanistan would be very bad, but the Russian heart is having a hard time dealing with what is needed to create a stable Afghanistan.
Well, and then of course there's the Russian stomach. I mean, Russia announced today, the government announced today that from a peak of $588 billion of foreign currency reserves last summer, it's declined to about $386 billion. The economy is really hobbling Russia, and I'm wondering if the implications of that are essentially a more cooperative relationship with the West rather than what Putin has been touting really for the last 2 years, and that is something much more confrontational.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, John, and that's what we're all trying to figure out at this point. We're all wondering, now that Russia has focused so much on the domestic arena, dealing with, for example, a sharply weaker ruble, an industrial base that's really in big trouble, and of course, most importantly, the sharp drop in the price of oil. As Russia and the Kremlin are dealing with that, does that mean that they need to be, that they will be a little less aggressive when dealing with the West? You have to couple that, of course, with the new Obama administration. And there's a very interesting dynamic that's going on right now, which is both sides are kind of trying to feel each other out, trying to figure out what's really going on. I think the Kremlin would like to improve relations with the Obama administration, and I think the Obama administration, you know, Vice President Joe Biden said they want to hit the reset button, quote-unquote, on relations with Russia. So both sides are really sort of trying to figure out what's going on here. But there are a number of major decisions, especially that the Obama administration has to make before I think the Kremlin can feel truly comfortable. The most important one is what to do about this anti-missile defense system that the Bush administration wanted to put in Poland and the Czech Republic, which greatly angered the Kremlin, rightly or wrongly, greatly angered them. And I think if the Obama administration pushes forward on that, it's hard to see relations with the Kremlin improving that much.
But, so then this Kyrgyzstan standoff about the base, and just remind us of the details of that, is really a bit of a snapshot of these sort of security debates. On the one hand, Kyrgyzstan has closed the base. On the other hand, Russia is really allowing access to its territory.
That's right. I think this is a bit of an issue of control. In other words, if the Americans have their base in Kyrgyzstan, and are maneuvering there on their own, and the Russians aren't able to exert much control over what's going on here, you know, the Russians are discomforted by that.
Right.
However, if material is being shipped across Russia down into Afghanistan, and the Russians can sort of have a better idea of what's going on in their, as I said, zone of influence, I think they can deal with that a little better.
Right.
So again, you know, the Russians want to feel like they have some role in this, that they are sort of exerting some influence over this,
well,
rightly or wrongly, because of course you get into the situation where if goods have to be shipped all the way across Russia rather than coming through some Central Asian republic, it's obviously hobbling the mission a little. It's making the effort to supply American forces in Afghanistan more difficult. So again, that's kind of the trade-off that the Russians want.
Well, the irony that you sort of point out in part in your article, and you say people are waiting to figure out as the Obama administration and the Medvedev government sort of feel each other out. I mean, the most serious negotiations between the U.S. and Russia may end up being about the $500 billion in corporate debt that's coming due in Russia, and all that's going to have to be renegotiated with Western economic sources. And so the first really big test of this may be economic, not really in national security terms. It's an interesting theme going forward, and it means that this U.S.-Russia relationship, I think, is unlike any other in really recent memory. New York Times' Clifford Levy, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me, John.
Clifford Levy is the Moscow bureau chief there in Moscow. And, you know, I could talk with him for another hour, but we're on the way out this hour. That's Clifford Levy joining us from Moscow. And we're always on, and we're looking for a six-word motto, as you are, to help America get through 2009.
Good morning. Joe from Bourbonnais, Illinois. My motto is, remember, tight wallets sink companies.
Kate writes on our website, live like it's 1929. Tell us your motto for America. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Freakonomics blog author Stephen Dubner joins us tomorrow with his favorites. Here's your takeaway.
You don't want Obama fatigue. You don't want him to be too oversaturated in the market. Yes, there are issues going on, but, you know, he has to find a balance so people will listen to what he has to say instead of just saying, oh, here he goes again.
It's April Ryan from American Urban Radio Network's podcast, our interview with April and the Detroit Free Press's Todd Spanger. You can get our podcast to go at iTunes. Good morning, Detroit. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
U.S. policy in South Asia. Someone's out to get us.
it's quite possible that as we sit here now, somewhere in the tribal areas of Pakistan, people are plotting an attack on the United States.
The Obama administration's envoy for South Asia, Richard Holbrooke, believes Pakistan is both an ally and the source of some serious threats. As troops surge into Afghanistan, there is a surge of interest in the entire region, searching for bin Laden in the era of slumdog millionaires. No final answers on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Adora Udoji is away. Coming up this hour, we'll take you to Pakistan for a discussion of the implications of U.S. policy there. Holbrooke spoke to PBS over the weekend, much more in that notion of a regional problem, and we're going to take a look at that. Plus, some believe there's a new color barrier around the baseball diamond. We'll examine the drop in African-American baseball players. Are baseball players too cerebral? Femi, okay, can you top that?
I think I can. With a top topic at the White House today, that is money. President Obama will gather a cast of dozens to talk about budget issues. He also meets with state governors who have stimulus money coming their way. Tuesday night, the president gives a speech to Congress, and Thursday he turns in his budget proposal. The president's goal is cutting the budget deficit in half by the end of his term, and he will do that mainly by raising taxes for the wealthy and cutting Iraq war spending.
If the economy makes you think you don't want to go into the banking business, too bad, you're already in it as a taxpayer. And news this morning says the government could soon go even deeper. The Wall Street Journal reports the government is in talks to buy as much as a 40% stake of Citigroup. Nearly 1 in 10 of your friends and neighbors could be out of a job this year, a grim forecast from a new report. The National Association for Business Economics predicts unemployment will hit 9% this year. Right now, it's already at a 16-year high. Femi?
Slumdog Millionaire is the big Academy Awards winner. It racked up 8 Oscars last night, and that includes Best Picture. Kate Winslet won for Best Actress. Sean Penn took home the Best Actor trophy. He played slain gay leader Harvey Milk. His acceptance speech referenced the gay rights battles of the California election.
I think that it is a good time for those who voted for the ban against gay marriage to sit and reflect and anticipate their great shame and the shame in their grandchildren's eyes if they continue that way of support. We've got to have equal rights for everyone.
Also getting a posthumous Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, Heath Ledger, and his family accepted it for him.
That was an emotional moment.
Indeed. And his mom spoke, his dad spoke, his sister spoke, and the actual statuette will go to his little daughter when she comes of age.
Oh, that's amazing. The Dow and the S&P dipped more than 1% on Friday. The S&P begins trading today at 770. Coming up, we have a discussion about the changing racial makeup of people in college baseball, and there's some great discussion by some African-American players about what it is that's special.
Right.
About baseball,
okay.
Maybe changing the participation. To get through the next few years, we're going to need a motto, folks. Help us.
Hi, my name's Quinn from Orlando, Florida, and my 6-word motto for the U.S. is consumption's the cure that ails us.
Can you do better than that? Tell us your 6-word motto at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The United States must have as President Obama said repeatedly last year, as Secretary Clinton said repeatedly last year, the U.S. government did not approach this as a regional problem. And President Obama's made clear we will.
It's Richard Holbrooke, the Obama administration's envoy to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, speaking on PBS over the weekend. What does that mean, a regional problem? we're talking about Afghanistan, the war on terror, or the instability inside Pakistan, or even policy towards India. We turn to New York Times reporter Eric Schmidt, who joins us from Islamabad. His front page story on the U.S. involvement in Pakistan suggests that the assistance and cooperation between the Pakistani military and U.S. military officials is closer than we've been led to believe. And first of all, Eric Schmidt, what have you discovered about the cooperative arrangements between the Pakistani military and the U.S.?
Well, what we found was that there is a special task force that was set up last summer here in Pakistan with more than 70 U.S. military advisors and technical specialists that are working secretly in the country to help Pakistan's military combat al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters, mainly in the tribal areas of Pakistan along the Afghan border. Now, there have been, the Pentagon has acknowledged that a small number of trainers came in late last year to train Pakistani soldiers who in turn would train paramilitary forces that combat Qaeda operatives. But this this task force represents a much broader and more ambitious program by the U.S. military, as well as the U.S. intelligence services working with their counterparts here in Pakistan.
Eric Schmidt, is this likely to be viewed as surprising at all by people in Pakistan, where this sort of arrangement, it tends to be controversial? And, of course, there are the overflights into Pakistani territory, which are controversial. It seems to me that most Pakistanis are fairly cynical about this anyway and believe that the U.S. might be running the show here.
Well, there certainly are many, many conspiracy theories in Pakistan here over what kind of control the U.S. really wants to have here and how many forces may be running around. As you said, the Predator drones that are operated by the CIA here. But I think both countries have taken pains to keep this program under wraps just because of the political sensitivities and the fear that public protests could cause the government here to withdraw some or all of the American trainers and forces that are helping. These are forces, by the way, that are not involved in combat operations. They're involved in training, advising on combat tactics. They may be asked to help arrange distribution of humanitarian aid. So it's very much in a supporting role.
Finally, Eric, much of this, as you report, predates the Obama inauguration. Yet, are there any hints in what you've discovered that suggest the way forward for Obama in terms of policy?
Well, I think as the lead-in here, as you said, with Ambassador Holbrooke talking about how this administration really is trying to focus this effort as a regional effort between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that's certainly something that the military and intelligence services here, that is the American services here, are trying to try and convey to the Pakistanis as well, that this really is not a problem that stops at either in any one border. It's a very porous border, and the flow of militants back and forth has to be combated on both sides. So I think if that emphasis is indeed a higher priority for the Obama administration, this effort may see some more support.
Eric Schmidt, thanks for joining us. Eric Schmidt, New York Times reporter. His front page story is all about U.S. cooperation with Pakistani military officials. He reported to us from Islamabad, Pakistan. It's in some sense a tempting moment to talk about the proximity of South Asia to the West. And when we look at the Oscars last night and the victory of Slumdog Millionaire and the sense that we and the people of India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan are maybe much closer than we might have thought 8 years ago, it's possibly a tempting moment to think that so much is possible now, but it certainly is a moment that motivates me to ask Ahmed Rashid, our next guest, who's a Pakistani journalist and the author of Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. He joins us this morning. Ahmed, I was sort of drawn into a sense that, wow, things could be much more positive in this region than they have, even thinking back to Thanksgiving and the Mumbai bombings. Do you share any of that optimism? And I suspect that your answer might not be yes.
No, I'm extremely pessimistic about Pakistan right now, and also Afghanistan, but perhaps slightly less. I think in Pakistan you have seen the lack of a strategic policy by the Bush administration over 7-8 years, which has led to the growth of the Taliban and al-Qaeda and its allies on Pakistani soil. They're spreading across northern Pakistan, and they there is this very controversial deal in the Swat Valley where it seems the state has almost surrendered the legal system to the Taliban. And I think Pakistan presents a much more difficult conundrum for the Obama administration and the review that it is carrying out. Afghanistan is a question of sheer neglect. It's a question of lack of money, lack of foreign troops, too slow a pace in building the Afghan army. Now, all these things can be rectified over time. In Pakistan, you have a much more complicated situation with not just a terrorist threat. You have a collapsing economy, and you also have very tense political relations between the government, the opposition, and the military.
Why does it seem, Ahmed Rashid, that the civilian government has managed to hold the line in at least delivering what seems to be a rational response to India's demands on the Mumbai bombings? I think if we were talking back in November, we would have thought things would have unraveled much more quickly.
Well, I mean, initially, you know, Pakistan was in a state of denial about the Mumbai bombings, and but subsequently, I think a lot was due to possibly Richard Holbrooke and international pressure from Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, who came here. I think that finally changed Pakistan's mind, and now there's much greater cooperation between Pakistan and India and the Americans at the intelligence level in trying to dig out who the perpetrators of Mumbai were. And there's now an admittance by Pakistan that some of them certainly were Pakistani and were trained in Pakistan. So, I mean, things are slightly better there, but we still do not, we have a complete stoppage of any kind of relationship between India and Pakistan at the moment. And, of course, both countries have got to talk to each other to resolve their problems.
Well, is there any model here, any sort of template for pulling levers and maybe delivering some pressure on to the government of Pakistan regarding the Swat Valley Agreement that, as you say, delivered legal autonomy to the Taliban in areas of Pakistan? Can Holbrooke and the U.S. and maybe Gordon Brown of the U.K. deliver a message that says that can't stand? And is there any manipulative, any room to move there?
Well, I think there is pressure being put, and at the moment the agreement has not been signed by the President Asif Zardari, who has to sign off on this agreement. It hasn't been signed by him, and secondly, there's every chance that the agreement is going to break down, because the Taliban in the Swat Valley are probably not going to lay down their arms, and they're not going to agree to some of the demands of the government. So it's a wait-and-see situation there. In addition to what, you know, Eric said, I think, you know, the crucial issue, I mean, yes, there has been enormous cooperation, a growing cooperation between the intelligence agencies of the U.S. and Pakistan, but I think the key factor has been the reluctance of the Pakistan military to actually train in counterinsurgency. What Eric Schmidt was referring to was the fact that the army has agreed for the Americans to train the paramilitary forces, the Frontier Corps, in counterinsurgency, but it has not yet agreed to train the regular army in counterinsurgency, because it feels that the major threat is still India and that it has to keep its armies mobilized for India not to fight, and the major threat is not the counterinsurgency that is needed against the Taliban. Now, that position can only shift when there is a better relationship between India and Pakistan, and when the Pakistanis feel more secure about the mega giant India on their border, which of course is a traditional enemy with which Pakistan has fought three wars.
Well, and that brings us back to the whole issue of this being a regional affair. If India and Pakistan do have a more stable, less tense relationship, it could argue for cooperative counterinsurgency efforts between Pakistan and the United States in the Swat Valley and in Afghanistan. Ahmed Rashid, thanks for delivering that analysis for us. He's a Pakistani journalist and author of Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. We're looking for a motto for America in 2009. You've given us some suggestions, and we just got this in from Sean Penn.
You commie, homo-loving sons of guns.
Oh, he can't possibly be serious. What's your motto for America? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Six words. That's what we need. And then we're out of here. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Some of you public radio listeners, I suppose, would call it a mantra. But for real Americans, it's a motto.
My name is Monica Otiaku, and I feel that drastic changes are necessary to turn around this economy. So my six words are, comfort is the enemy of success.
Nice. How can you do better than that at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org? A six-word motto. Andy writes on our site, give credit when credit is due. We're going to judge all these six-word mottos tomorrow with our friend Freakonomics blogger Stephen Dubner. But weigh in, all right? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. It is my great pleasure this morning to introduce Jerome Vaughn, who's a news director and program director at WDET, the public radio station, part of the public radio system there in Detroit, where we go on the air at this moment. I mean, we are on the air as of this morning.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and we're glad to have you on in Detroit. I've been looking for something new, something to tell the city what's going on around the rest of the world, and where else than here to rely on it.
Well, we spend so much time going to Detroit, whether it's your reporters or people in the Detroit area, to really get a feel for what's going on with the stimulus package and just how the economy is really manifesting itself in your community. This seems to be a really crucial time to be bringing the Detroit community into this conversation. What are some of the headlines?
Well, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. What Detroiters are thinking about, worrying about all the time now, or, you know, what's going on with the auto industry, that ripples out into jobs, that ripples out into the foreclosures, that ripples out into the neighborhoods and how they're surviving. And so that's what people are thinking about and digesting just about every day.
And we're going to be relying on you all week to be a co-host eventually in the next couple of days on the program. But when you get back to Detroit, bringing people from your community into that conversation. I grew up in Western Michigan, which is a whole different world than Detroit. But still, you know, I think the voices of the people actually on this main street, this very important main street, are very, very important voices, and we're going to be relying on you.
Well, we're going to do our best to bring you that day in and day out as much as we can. You know, Detroit is ahead of the curve as far as this financial problem goes. We've been in bad shape for a while, and hopefully there'll be some solutions there that the rest of the country can chime in on.
And if not, you can just focus on the Tigers, right? Oh, maybe not. Maybe not. That's been a painful subject.
Better than the Lions, at
Better
least.
Than the Lions. Yes, indeed. Well, we are going to talk baseball this morning because the wind chill here in New York is about 14 degrees. It's a perfect time to talk baseball with our friend Jeff Beresford Howe, Takeaway Sports contributor. He's out in Los Angeles. And Jeff, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
And meet Jerome Vaughn of WDET.
Nice to meet you, Jerome.
Now, oh, go ahead, say.
Good to meet you, Jeff.
Be a good host, John, for heaven's sakes. Now, Jeff, you observed, as part of your coverage of the opening of the college baseball season, a phenomenon which could have a big impact on the lineup of baseball teams going forward in the pros. Explain what it is you've discovered and who you talked to try to get to the roots of it.
Went to games this weekend at the Urban Youth Academy in Compton, California. Compton, if you don't know, is a city a little bit south of Los Angeles, mostly minority, very, very poor, a lot of gangs, only half the kids who go to school, high school there graduate. And it's the center of an effort by Major League Baseball to try and reintroduce young African Americans to baseball.
And the statistics of the kinds of players that you met there would suggest that African-American participation in baseball at the college level is going down precipitously.
participation in the college level for African Americans is virtually nil. At this point, only 6% of college baseball players are African American, but that figure is distorted by a few historically black colleges. In the Pac-10, for example, which is the best baseball conference in the country, only about 3% of the players are black, 15 black players in the entire Pac-10.
How much of this is a result of the proliferation over the last few years of baseball camps, kind of high-end baseball camps in communities all over the country, where the tuition is hardly affordable by people other than, you know, maybe some upscale white families?
It's a combination of the camps, the so-called traveling squads, which give a real immersion in baseball experience and top-level coaching. It's also the fact, as Daryl Miller, who runs the Youth Academy, likes to point out, that in college baseball, there is only one black coach at an upper-level Division I school, and those the white coaches are just not reaching out into the black community to find kids to play.
Well, let's hear to what something of what Daryl Miller told you when you spoke over the weekend. Here he is.
We see most of our kids are focused a lot more on football because there's 80 scholarship opportunities. Baseball has 11.7, so most of those are partial scholarships that are given out. And if you're economically disadvantaged, if you do the math, that doesn't work for you at a major university. Or basketball scholarships. There's 15 scholarships and there's 12 guys on a team. Everyone on that team has a full ride.
You know, that he lays out the economics there. And Jerome, I'm wondering if that is something that resonates with you. You've got 70, 80 kids who are thinking about the pro sports, maybe?
No, just two right now. But I guess it is a good question. I mean, if you're looking at the economics, I mean, I know so many kids in Detroit that don't even have a baseball glove. What I want to know, Jeff, is how long, why did it take so long for Major League Baseball to catch on?
Well, the figures for African Americans in Major League Baseball have been dropping for years. It was 27% Major League players in 1975, and it's about 8% now. I think what got people's attention was when teams started to begin the season with no African American players on their roster. Recently, the Atlanta Braves and the Houston Astros both did that. There's a good chance the Oakland A's are going to do that this year. And black players in baseball, many of whom are now who played in the 60s and 70s are now in positions of authority, began to sound the alarm. They said, hey, where are all the kids? That when we went to school, six, seven, eight kids on our high school teams would play minor league baseball, and some of those would make the majors. And right now we're seeing at schools like Crenshaw in Los Angeles, which used to be a baseball factory, you're seeing no kids.
Well, let's get it.
College, let alone the pros.
Let's hear a voice from Crenshaw, and then in a couple of seconds, just a reaction, because this is a fascinating statement from a kid named Cameron Hart.
I chose baseball over football because I've always been good in football. Anybody can play football, but it takes a 75% cerebral person and 25% athletic person to play baseball, and you can't find that in everyone.
Jeff, take us out on that. That's fascinating.
Well, Cameron is dealing with his strong suit there. He's at Cal on a full academic scholarship. The kid is really bright. But, kids, what Cameron calls the LeBron factor, kids are focusing on basketball and football
right
and just don't see baseball as a way to
right,
go forward.
Right. Jeff Barrister, Ohio Takeaway Sports Contributor, thanks for joining us. And Jerome, thanks for being with us. More this week.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, a moral issue that looks a little bit like pork, but maybe plays like actual stimulus in the economy. We'll talk about a part of the stimulus package involving Philippine war veterans from World War II. But first, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. State governors return to the White House today for a final discussion on spending economic stimulus money. There, the president is expected to announce that Interior Department Inspector General Earl Devaney will head a board overseeing stimulus spending, and he has a record of uncovering corruption. Slumdog Millionaire was the big winner at the Oscars last night. It won 8 in all, including the Best Picture and Best Song. Here's a little bit from Best Song. It's called Jai Ho. If you're wondering what it means, it means be victorious. The song's composer is A.R. Rahman. Danny Boyle also took home the Best Director Award for the film. Other winners included Sean Penn as Best Actor and Kate Winslet, who won Best Actress for The Reader. Attorney General Eric Holder visits Guantanamo Bay, Cuba today. He's on a fact-finding mission. Later, he will lead a panel with Defense Secretary Robert Gates to review U.S. detention policy. President Obama has the goal of closing Guantanamo within a year. Egyptian police are questioning three suspects in the bombing of a cafe in Cairo that killed a French tourist and injured more than 20 other people. The explosion hit a historic area popular with visitors, and no group has taken responsibility for the bombing yet. That's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And all week with us is Jerome Vaughn, news program director from newest member station, Detroit WDET, joins us all week as we say welcome to Detroit. And we're going to together look into a story that was buried deep into the fine print of the stimulus package. And you may not or may have been aware of it, but at one point in the debate over the stimulus package, this moral issue was put to the floor of the House by Representative Bob Filner of California.
After the war was over, after we had won in both the Atlantic and the Pacific, the Philippines were granted their independence. And the Congress of 1946 said, you got your independence, you take care of your veterans. Yes, you saved America, but that's your problem, not ours anymore.
Well, $198 million is authorized for spending from the stimulus bill to actually go to Filipino World War II veterans in checks as high as $15,000, essentially paying them what would have been war pensions and, literally paying them for being a part of the guerrilla operations in World War II that helped the Allied cause in the Pacific. Joining us now is Eric Lachica, who's an advisor to the American Coalition for Filipino Veterans. He's also a son of a Filipino World War II veteran. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And Amadeo Urbano is a World War II veteran. He's also on the line with us from Virginia. Amadeo, good morning and congratulations to you.
Thank you.
And, what do you think of finally the U.S. government kind of coming around and recognizing this omission?
Well, we are exceedingly happy and elated about the move made by the United States government. You know, after 63 years waiting and working for the passage of this Filipino Veterans Equity Bill, this stimulus package bill, which included provisions of this Filipino veterans issue, was passed just recently. And we are very happy for Senator Inouye for his efforts in defending our cause in the Senate floor.
Oh, you're after referring all, to Senator Inouye of Hawaii, who was one of the chief backers of the bill. Eric, some have said that this bill doesn't amount to stimulus, that it's more a sort of pet project of Senator Inouye and Congressman Filner. But all these checks going to communities around the country could possibly have some stimulus impact, don't you think?
Yes. Senator Inouye and more or less reflected the will of the U.S. Senate, because even last year they overwhelmingly passed 97-1 to set aside funds for the Filipino World War II veterans. So the monies, were just being released by the
by the stimulus bill. There was already many money set aside in appropriation back in September.
But what do you say to people who say, you know, this is pork, this has nothing to do with stimulus, there's no economics here, maybe there's a moral issue, but come on.
Well, you know, that's why, you know, U.S. veterans receive pensions for their service. It, in many ways, pumps up the U.S. economy, and Filipinos, be they veterans in the United States or in the Philippines, you know, they are American consumers. The highest number of Americans living overseas, in Asia especially, is in the Philippines. So this is part of the close, relationship between the two countries.
Well, let's talk about how this stimulus is actually going to work. Amadeo, if you get a check for as high as $15,000, I imagine, first of all, there's a big party in it for somebody in your community, right?
Yes.
And that's going to involve caterers and, you know, people, selling all kinds of things. I mean, entire communities are involved in this payout. Am I right, Eric?
Yeah, you're right. That's right.
Well, Amadeo, congratulations. I know lump sum sounds like a welcome relief in these economic times. Eric,
yes.
I gather most people are going to spend that money. Is that what your supposition is?
Yes, John. Many of our veterans are setting aside the monies for their grandkids, the expenses. Many of them are also buying medicines, especially in the Philippines. It's a very, very poor country. And, in fact, it's going to go boost the economy of the United States by all of these new consumers spending.
Well, call it what you will, and good luck over the next few weeks. Eric Lachica, advisor to the American Coalition for Filipino Veterans, and also Amadeo Urbano, who is an actual Filipino World War II veteran. Congratulations to both of you in the stimulus package, $198 million of spending to go to World War II veterans. There are estimated 13 to 16,000 still alive in America who were a part of the fight of the Allies in World War II, finally getting compensation from the U.S. government. How can we help the United States get through 2009? Well, we could start by giving it a mantra, something catchy, maybe with six words or something.
This is Miranda in South Carolina. I guess my six-word motto would be endlessly throwing good money after bad.
Okay, Josh from Ohio in Michigan. No, that's not true. He emails us, live within means, not credit limits. We are looking for a six-word motto to help America get through these troubled times. Why, you ask? Well, our friend Stephen Dubner has been doing this for a while. America needs a motto. Not that there's anything wrong with In God We Trust. But, let's put six words together and make something useful, something that's going to be passionate, something that's going to motivate us all to come together, something like Sean Penn said last night.
You commie, homo-loving sons of guns.
And that was more than six words. Maybe not Sean as an example, but to give us your suggestion, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and not since Sixth Sense and M. Night Shyamalan have Indians been so riveted on the Oscar celebration. Last night, hi-ho, Slumdog Millionaire took home the Oscar for Best Picture and seven other prizes. Listen to some of the reaction.
Getting these kind of awards is good.
Well, it's a good movie. The story is right what they have shown in the movie.
Definitely, we are very happy getting that because we got Oscar award.
These kind of stuff, you know, sells in the West. People in the slum, they don't go to see movies in the multiplexes and all. It sells there. That's why they're making these kind of movies. I don't care about, you know, if it won the award or whatever.
A mixed verdict there on the streets of Mumbai. Linda Blake is a freelance TV producer and radio reporter in Delhi. Linda, what was the reaction to the win? It seems as though some people were really, really, kind of boosters of the movie, but it also sends a mixed message for certain people in India. Linda?
Hey, John, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Well, look, one Delhi reporter put it best. I mean, you go to the slums in Mumbai, people are cheering. They're praising, singing Jai Ho in the air, you know, the hit song. It's kind of the Yes We Can of India now, right? But at the same time, you ask these same people, okay, what are the Oscars? They don't even know. They know they should celebrate and that they dig the song, but they're not 100% sure, a good amount of the slum dwellers in Mumbai, what the Oscars are and kind of what that resonance is. So you go there, you see that. Then you go to kind of some of the higher echelons of society, and you look to the middle class, the type that, you know, will go to their McDonald's and have their extendable income and order the McAloo Tiki, and they're a bit concerned about this. They don't like that, you know, there's this sort of representation of India as sort of this impoverished country when there's been a 9% GDP growth, you know, in the past year. So there's really a want to get a full, thorough picture of India expressed in Western society.
But some of the images are so compelling. I mean, as compelling as Slumdog Millionaire itself was as a story for people unfamiliar with India. Mm-hmm. I saw a picture this morning in the Times of London that there were like 60 or 70 people all perched in front of a little television that was on a rickety stand watching the Oscars last night.
Right, and I think you really hit it, though. It's compelling for people who are unfamiliar with India. You look at the release of Slumdog Millionaire here in India after the Oscar nominations were announced. You look in any theater, about 25% of that theater was full. Why? Because these images are compelling for Westerners, but for a lot of Indians, and even for myself, who works as an expat, you know, I'm walking down the street, I have children, bless them, you know, begging, dirt-caked hands, tugging at my sleeves, asking for a biscuit most days. So it's very much in your face, and there's that thought, do you want to see that sort of shock and awe in the theaters as an Indian, or do you want to use the theater as kind of a Bollywood escapist method?
Well, maybe it's an export. I mean, in the same way that Hollywood doesn't really reflect actual life in the United States, is it possible these heroic images from India are a kind of cultural export, and we only just have a couple of seconds? What do you think?
I think that if indeed it is an export, let's hope that there also is a real understanding. Yes, this story is rags to riches within the plot line. Let's hope that there's also a story expressed about India's rags to riches journey.
Well, there's certainly plenty to talk about there, a complex, mixed reaction to the success of Slumdog Millionaire. Thanks for joining us, Linda Blake, freelance TV producer and radio reporter, self-described expat there on the streets of Delhi, India. Thanks, Linda.
Thanks so much. Don't got a six-word motto for you, but I can say Jai Ho repeatedly.
Good job. Jai Ho. Jai Ho three times. That's a motto.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Just one more time with Femi Okay. As painful as it is, one more time with Femi Okay.
This one will be good, I promise you. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The other 15, maybe not so much. The 81st Academy Awards ended last night with Sean Penn taking the Best Actor Award for Milk and Kate Winslet won her first Best Actress Oscar for The Reader. Both actors paid tribute to their competition. Sean Penn acknowledged Mickey Rourke and Kate Winslet paid homage to Meryl Streep.
I want to acknowledge my fellow nominees, these goddesses. I think we all can't believe we were in a category with Meryl Streep at all. I'm sorry, Meryl, but you have to just suck that up.
But the big star of the night was the movie Slumdog Millionaire with an impressive haul of 8 Oscars, including Best Picture. The Treasury Department and other federal agencies say that they will inject more money into struggling banks starting on Wednesday, and their statement didn't mention specific companies. This comes as the Wall Street Journal reports the government is in talks to take as much as a 40% stake in Citigroup. President Obama will host lawmakers and economists today for a fiscal responsibility summit. They will discuss how to curb the deficit, The president's goal is to cut it in half by the end of his term, and he's submitting his budget plan to Congress on Thursday. That's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Parting is such sweet sorrow on the way out here.
I'll get you later.
America needs a motto for 2009. You've got some ideas, especially from our new station, WDET, there in the Detroit area. From Royal Oak, Michigan, Mike mails us, volunteering is better than not working. Lisa in Ypsilanti, Michigan, home of Eastern Michigan University, has volunteering on her mind, too. She says, less mindless TV, more community service. Mitch in Paris, Michigan, says he borrowed money from a family member for an investment he was making. The website he used had a great motto and wants to give it its due. Keep your money in your family. Give us a phrase to comfort us in these troubled times, wherever you are from. Call us with your six-word motto at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow, Freakonomics blogger Stephen Dubner is going to judge them and give us his bizarre methodology for figuring out what's the best motto going forward. If you caught the president speaking over the weekend, you may have gathered that one of the ways he plans to reduce the deficit is to produce cost savings by scaling down the U.S. troop presence in Iraq. But how fast and on what scale? How much money does that represent? It's the real question. Helping us do the math this morning is Linda Bilmes, who we welcome back to the program. Linda, Harvard professor of public finance and co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of the book The $3 Trillion War. She's also the author of a new book, The People Factor, Strengthening America by Investing in Public Service. Linda, thanks for coming back to the program.
Thank you.
If President Obama attempts to use Iraq as a principal source of savings by drawing down the U.S. Commitment there, how much money can be expected? And let's just confine ourselves to this fiscal year, if we could.
Well, the problem with trying to save money in Iraq is that while I certainly agree with the president that we need to draw down our troops, it actually turns out to be pretty complicated to save money there. And you can think about this for several reasons. But first of all, the Iraq operation is a very high fixed-cost operation. It's kind of like running an airplane where the bulk of the costs are there regardless of whether you have 10 passengers on the airplane or 200. You're still going to basically be paying quite a lot of the same cost.
So you can ground the fleet, but you're not going to dismantle the airports.
Right. And, in this case, we're still flying the plane. So, in other words, if we cut 10% of the troops, we don't save 10%. If you think about what costs money in a war, we spend money on repairs, on replacing equipment, on fuel, on training the local security forces, on reconstruction cost, and on much of the money is tied up in very expensive contracts that have been negotiated over a period of years, for example, maintaining military bases. And it turns out, as we saw when the British pulled out of most of the troops out of Basra, and it cost the same. It turns out that it actually is very difficult to save money until you bring a really large percentage of the troops home. In addition, and this is a very important point, the costs don't just stop when the troops come home. We actually end up spending a considerable amount of money on veterans benefits, on veterans health care, on education benefits for veterans, and we can see this clearly, for example, looking back to the 1991 first Gulf War, where even though that war only lasted for a month, we still spent $4 billion a year in veterans benefits, veterans disability benefits for the troops who fought in that war.
Well, we also have the complicating factor in this particular war with so many survivors and with these kinds of bizarre polytrauma injuries and serious burns and brain injuries that I read somewhere, I think the per capita expense on medical rehab over the very, very long haul could be higher for these troops than any troops in U.S. history.
Well, that's right. The number of troops who have been wounded or injured in this war, it is about 16 to 1 in terms of compared with fatalities, and that is much higher than in previous wars where it was about 3 to 1. But really, the large cost is in the the bulk of troops who are coming home who don't have polytrauma, who don't have, fortunately, such severe injuries, but they may be coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, with mild traumatic brain injuries, with mild injuries that require disability benefits to some extent and medical treatment for many, many decades.
Well, then, before we go, if the Obama administration was to embark on a cost savings on the scale that would actually reduce our spending in some significant deficit-reducing way, what would you look for as a sign that they're actually going down this road? And if Iraq isn't a source for savings, what is in the budget at this point?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, on the Iraq situation, in my opinion, and taking aside the fact that we are ramping up in Afghanistan at the same time that we are attempting
right.
to ramp down in Iraq, the only way to significantly save money in the Iraq operations as we bring our troops home is to revisit many of the large contracts, which are so expensive, and to close many of the bases, which are very expensive to maintain. And as I mentioned, these bases cost pretty much the same, regardless of how many troops you have on them. If you look at the history of the Iraq war, the number of personnel since 2004 has only increased by about 15%, but the costs have gone up by 93%.
Oh, that's amazing.
And, you know, that is largely due to the contracting for more equipment, for the cost of training and equipping the local security forces, and the cost of repairing and replacing equipment, most of which is done by contractors. So without revisiting the fundamental structure of how we fund the operations there in Iraq, it will be very difficult to, in the short term, to enjoy many financial benefit savings.
Well, if not Iraq, then where? I'll give you about a minute.
I am in favor of activity-based costing throughout the budget. That means that instead of looking at what we spend historically on things, looking at what it costs to actually provide services. This is a method that in a number of cities around the country has been able to bring budgets under control, but it has eluded the federal government up until this point.
Well, it sounds like that's an argument to bring you back and explain a little even more clearly how that would work and what sort of overhauls would be implied by adopting that sort of strategy. What's the name of it again?
Activity-based costing.
Activity-based costing,
all right. Or activity-based budgeting, it's basically a different way of thinking about the budget. In other words, instead of just looking at the fire department and what it costs, you look at what it costs to fight
right.
a fire, which actually transcends a number of departments, the police, the fire, the paramedics.
Activity-based costing. Let's Google that now overnight. Linda Bilmes, thanks so much for being with us. She's a Harvard professor of public finance and co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of the book The $3 Trillion War About Iraq. She's also the author of a new book called The People Factor, Strengthening America by Investing in Public Service. Because we're always on, we have jobs for all of you, and that's looking for a six-word motto to help America get through 2009. We've got some contenders.
Buy often, buy American. Buy now.
Endlessly throwing good money after bad.
Remember, tight wallets, sink companies.
Comfort is the enemy of success.
Tell us your motto for America. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Our friend and Freakonomics blogger Stephen Dubner joins us tomorrow with his favorites, and he'll tell us how he judged, too. You know, it's always kind of strange getting into Dubner's mind, but I love it. And your takeaway comes from The Dugout, of course.
In college baseball, there is only one black coach in upper-level Division I school, and the white coaches are just not reaching out into the black community to find kids to play.
Takeaway sports contributor Jeff Beresford Howe talking about a demographic shift in baseball. If you missed anything like that interview with Jeff, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org. We want to thank Detroit for joining us this morning, and Jerome Vaughn's going to be with us tomorrow from WDET in Detroit. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.